I want to tell you that, that I think this is an indication of how much I like the book. When Athenaeum sent me a copy of the book, they sent me it was a second printing. So I went out and went to a bookstore and I bought a first printing because I admired the book and I thought this is going to become either a minor or major little horror classic, The Invisible Man updated. And,
that's very kind, thank you.
So I wanted to hang on to the book. I really liked it. Now, they sent over some biographical data, which was kind of interesting about yourself, but I thought it'd be better for you to tell me about your own background directly. Memoirs of an Invisible Man is your first book, so you have not had a literary background per se. Tell me about yourself and how it all began for you.
Well, actually, I once published a short story when I was in graduate school studying philosophy, and I worked several months on it and was lucky enough to get it published by Esquire, and they sent me back a check for $600, so I was, I think, economically worse off after I'd sold it than when I'd begun, and I saw that I wasn't going to be able to feed many mouths that way. And I wound up being a businessman for 20 years or so. But I'd always really wanted to write. I mean, I think at any time in my life, from adolescence on, if you'd given me a choice, I'd have chosen to be a writer.
Well, where were you born?
In New York.
Mm-hmm. Manhattan?
No, upstate New York. Syracuse, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, where'd you go to school?
I went to school in outside of Philadelphia and in New York suburbs, and I went away to boarding school in Connecticut.
College?
And Haverford College, and I studied philosophy in Germany.
Haverford? Did you say Haverford?
Haverford, yeah.
And that's in...
That's outside... outside Philadelphia.
Well, that's the Quaker.
Well, that's
Quaker
right.
School. I know.
That's right.
There's a very fine writer who went to that school, named Hugh Nissenson. I don't know if you've ever run across his work, but he's a wonderful writer. He lives in Manhattan on the west side. His last book, which was nominated for an America Book Award, was called The Tree of Life, about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he found Haverford a very positive experience. What did you study there?
I studied philosophy.
Did you grow up in a literary family? Were there any kind of literary influences on you when you were growing up?
I think everyone in my family read. That's probably true of most writers. At some time you have to have done a lot of reading, and there were always lots of books around. So I probably was lucky to have been born just before television took over. So I spent all those hours reading books instead of looking at television.
Yeah, I missed television. I was in college and my father got a television set. He was waiting, this was in the 50s, he was waiting for color. He finally gave up, you know, and finally got a television set. When I was in high school, and the teacher would say, "Who saw such and such on television last night?" Everybody would raise their hand, you know, except me. You know,
that's right.
Pretend that we had a television set, but we never did. He was really holding out for this color, you know.
Well, he was right in the end.
Just much better out for
color.
15 more years and you'll get it. So I missed. I would come back from college, though, and I would watch television sometimes. We could only pick up two channels, and he had a rotor mechanism on the roof, you know, so that it would move the antenna.
That's right. It would turn or at least you believed it was turning up there somewhere.
Yeah, it did turn. It was kind of interesting, it would pick up two stations, KDKA. Actually, it was WDTV in Pittsburgh or WJAC in Johnstown. Johnstown channel didn't come on very well. It was all snowy. But you could watch things like Playhouse 90 and some of these old live shows, which were very good.
I think actually some television nowadays is very good. And things for children, I think, are often extraordinary. I'm not so fanatically against it as my parents were.
Well, I remember taking my kid to a school. I'm not sure I recall the name of it. But it was a rather exclusive school with a Germanic background on the east side of Manhattan. And they said, "You realize that at this school, we do not allow any of our students to listen to the radio or watch television, that it's pure book learning." And I said, well, I didn't know this. You know, when I read the brochure, they didn't indicate this. And I said, do you know what business I am in? You know, I've been in 25 years, I've been in broadcasting business, and I think that broadcasting is one of the greatest educational tools ever. Television could be abused, and a lot of cheap stuff, but there are a lot of cheap books, too. So
absolutely,
that school would never have worked out for my kid, anyway. Well, now, after Haverford, did you say you went off to Europe?
Yes, I studied philosophy in Germany for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I, partway through, I wound up inheriting a business and went back and worked in that never got back to doing anything academic and didn't get back to writing, at least for publication, and for another 20 years.
What was this business that you inherited?
Is actually a real estate business out in Pennsylvania.
And are you still involved in that?
No. I've been involved with some other businesses then, and the last thing I was doing before I started writing again was a business building squash clubs and fitness clubs, and mostly here in New York. We also did some in Washington.
Is this like a contracting business?
No, we built the clubs and set them up and ran them.
Are you still involved in that?
No. I sold about 5 years ago, I sold my interest in that business and decided that this was really probably my last opportunity to be a writer, to give it a try, and I set out to write a book that I thought would have some chance of doing well enough so that I'd be able to spend the rest of my life writing.
Ah, so 5 years ago you made this decision.
Yes, I assumed it would involve a big sacrifice in income, which it did for a while.
All right, so 5 years ago you were living in Manhattan at the time? So 5 years ago you gave up the business, decided that you would write or seek to write for a living. You obviously had a grubstake to carry you for a while.
Yes, I could go for a while, although I have 4 children in school. So.
Ouch. How old are they?
They range from 19 down to 5.
That's a pretty wicked spread.
Yes. I have the full range of problems.
So, what did you decide to write about 5 years ago?
Well, you know, people ask me all the time how I came upon the idea. It's such the invisibility itself is such an unoriginal idea that I can't really say. It's been done so many times over the last couple thousand years. But at some point, I thought a way to do something to give that premise a different treatment and say something different with it, have a different kind of fun with it. And I was sure as soon as I saw the idea that was the book I was going to do, that was what I was going to try to establish myself as a writer with.
So you, from the very outset, you began working on this book, your first book and the first piece of writing that you did since that Esquire story.
Yes, actually, I'd worked on things on my own in the course of that 20 years, but I'd never sent anything off to be published, and mostly hadn't finished anything. There was never really any pressure on me to complete anything.
Well, I think the Memoirs of an Invisible Man is very original, even though you say the idea of invisibility has come into play for years. The interesting thing, though, is to me, is the way you have thought everything out. Everything was carefully planned. The situations that person can get into when he is invisible, because you set up certain priorities, procedures, characteristics of this person that don't change. It's not like just being invisible and walking through walls. I mean, your character is very, very physical. So obviously, in that sense, he has to get out of certain situations that he couldn't, unless he were indeed, as his girlfriend thought, he might be a ghost.
It's usually invisibility has been used as a kind of magical power, which which sets the person who has it, it frees him from all the problems and constraints of everyday life, whereas here it's exactly right. It's everything else is treated is just as it was and treated very literally, and the hero who's become invisible by accident finds that instead of being a magical power, invisibility makes all his problems and all the limitations of everyday life much more severe than they ever were before, and his life is difficult because government agents very logically decide he would make a splendid laboratory animal, and as soon as they find out about him, they're after him, and he has other ideas and tries to set off to create some kind of independent life. And the first thing he notices is that as he walks across the lawn, his footsteps appear as a kind of diagram of a dance step, and every instant of his life from then on is an agony, because he's always having to watch for collisions from automobiles or joggers or bicycles, and come at him from any direction and finish him off.
Well, it's scary and funny at the same time. There's the one hilarious scene, for example, where he has met, I can't remember the name of the young woman he meets at the party.
Alice, probably.
Alice. And they're in the taxi cab. They get in the backseat of the taxi cab, and of course they're petting very heavily in the backseat, and the cab driver, I guess, is looking through the window and sees Alice there with her tongue down some invisible man's throat. And, I mean, that's a wonderful, hilarious scene. I just burst out laughing. So you really set up situations that could be real, except that the poor guy is invisible.
Well, the book was tremendous fun to write, actually, because the scene, all sorts of human interactions, whether it's his romantic involvement with that girl or just going through a revolving door, suddenly those things become tremendous fun to write, in something which might be quite formulaic otherwise, you get to have a lot of fun with. And I had a terrific time doing that scene, and also just wandering through New York, working out how someone would solve this problem in that situation I spent.
God, did you have a free run at one or more of these clubs where your hero is in hiding? Because you set this up very nicely. I mean, he's obviously familiar with almost every nook and cranny of the club. So, but you had to be familiar too, didn't you?
Well, I've been inside some of them, and it seemed like a logical place for this particular character to go.
Well, the book, I understand that it is going to be made into a motion picture and has already been acquired for translation into 10 foreign languages. Now, that's not a bad start for a first novel, is it?
No, I feel a little bit as if I'd won the lottery. Yes, the Warner Brothers has bought the book for Chevy Chase, and William Goldman's writing the screenplay right now, and I think that should be a lot of fun.
Are you going to work as an advisor or consultant on the project?
Well, I think William Goldman probably is much more qualified than I to write the screenplay.
I don't know about that. You're dealing with a very unusual and difficult treatment. I mean, this is not going to be the easiest thing in the world to put together, is it?
It will be hard to make, and they'll, for one thing, I guess, have to shoot every scene twice, once with the protagonist visible, and once with him invisible, once with him not in the picture. So they'll be able to go back and forth, seeing it both from his point of view and from a spectator's point of view who can't see him.
Yeah, now, Chevy Chase is to play the Invisible Man?
Chevy Chase is to play the Invisible Man.
How are they going to do that? I mean, I was thinking, as I was reading the book, I said, boy, this is going to be a tremendous picture, but how are they going to do it? They could have just kind of like a shimmering image or something.
I think they'll go back and forth, and they'll develop some vocabulary for so that the spectator will know now, although you can't see him, he's there. You'll see something moving. And then the camera will move away, and when it'll come back, you'll be able to see Chevy Chase there, so you can see what he's doing, even though the other characters can't see him. In fact, he can't see himself.
Well, it's going to be a difficult project. It'll be very interesting to see how they overcome the technical aspects. How has Memoirs of an Invisible Man changed your life?
Well, the biggest change is the one I hoped for from the beginning, which means I'll be able to spend the rest of my life writing. It's of course unusual for someone to have so much good luck with a first novel, and beyond that, I suppose I've gotten phone calls from lots of people I haven't spoken to in 20 years, and it's sometimes quite seductive, actually, and people, especially when the reviews were coming out, and there was lots of attention being given to the book in the press. People would be calling up all the time and telling me how splendid the book was and how splendid I was, and I began to see how difficult it is for real celebrities, actors and actresses. You hear this sort of thing all day, and you, if you're not careful, you start believing it. You start wondering why the phone hasn't rung yet today.
Pretty soon they'll give you offers to do Rose's Lime Juice advertising. Well, now, this must have come out, you must have finished the actual manuscript a year or more ago. What have you been doing over this past year?
Well, I finished it, that's right, late last year, and I've started to work on another book, and I've been doing some work promoting this, and catching up on some things I let go while I was finishing this.
Can you tell us what the theme of the new book will be?
Well, it won't be about invisibility. It won't be a sequel. I'm done with invisibility as a premise.
Not going to tip us off in any way, huh? It's going to be something radically different?
Well, it'll be set in New York. It'll be quite different. Yeah.
Well, I'm certainly going to look forward to reading that, H.F. Saint. And why did you decide to use H.F. instead of Harry?
Oh, I think partly because of the play on H.G. Wells, it seemed like fun, and also because it was a little. I originally wanted to use another name, and the publisher who had paid me a $5,000 advance assured me that my editor assured me that it really wasn't necessary, that not many people would notice the book anyway, and.
Well, why don't you use John Updike? Then they would know.
That would have been a good idea.
Or William Styron, The Memoirs of an Invisible Man by William Styron. People would go by.
I'd have used all the proceeds on the lawsuit.
Well, I don't think they can. They can't copyright names, can they? Or titles?
I think probably if you change your name with some kind of intent to defraud, they can.
Maybe right. I was thinking about changing the name of this broadcast from Don Swain's Book Beat to Woody Allen's Book Beat, but I know Woody he does have a tendency to file lawsuits, so I won't do that.
I'll check with him first.
Have you been hanging around, by the way, speaking of Woody,
at Elaine's?
At Elaine's and this sort of thing?
I haven't been into Elaine's for years.
I haven't either. I'm waiting for Woody
to invite you. Sorry.
I feel too uncomfortable going by myself, so I've asked Woody to invite me the next time he goes. He hasn't done it, so I guess I just won't make it to Elaine's till he does. Well, H.F. Saint, it's a wonderful book, and I really enjoyed it, and I wish you the best of success with it. I'll look forward to the movie, and I'll certainly look forward to your new book, whatever it may be about. I know it'll be set in New York, so I'm looking forward to that. But it's always nice reading a book like this and reading about places you've been to, streets you've been across, and this sort of thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Sharing with me.